In 2008, Eric Weiner wrote a best-selling book called The Geography of Bliss. And Weiner was a New York Times reporter and an NPR correspondent who decided to go study happiness. And he did this, he mentions in the book, because, well, he was profoundly unhappy. So why not go study happiness? And Weiner, he has the perfect last name for a grump. I mean, apparently it's not a pen name. Apparently it's his real name. He decided to go out and study happiness like a good reporter would by going to what purported to be the happiest countries on earth, living among them for a few weeks, interviewing a whole bunch of people and trying to figure out why they're happy. Now, what Weiner did at the beginning of his research, in fact, the thing that spurred on the book, was he discovered that happiness is now an academic subject. Believe it or not, you can go out to California to Claremont Graduate School, which is actually a fine school, and actually get a PhD in happiness studies. Why would you study anything else? I mean, honestly, you can go get a PhD in happiness studies. And this has come up through a movement in psychology called the positive psychology movement, which is a movement within psychology to try and focus on what's going right in your life instead of what's going wrong. Thinking of that, if we try and extend what's going right in our lives, it will lead to better lives. Well, there is a particular man in the Netherlands that put happiness studies on the map, and his name is Ruud Vinderhoven. Vinderhoven, about 25 years ago, started to study happiness, and he convinced a very skeptical academy that happiness could be studied. You could imagine the skepticism of saying, well, you know, I want to study happiness, and I think I can bring some academic rigor to it. The big thing that he figured out is that if you ask people whether they're happy or not, they'll tell you. And in fact, pretty much they'll tell you accurately. In fact, they can tell you on a sliding scale about just how happy they are. And so if you've ever read a magazine article or a newspaper article about the happiest countries on earth, this comes out of Vinderhoven's work. He actually maintains something called the World Database of Happiness, in which all the collected wisdom of the world is centered into one place. Disneyland may think it's the happiest place on earth, but they haven't met Ruud Vinderhoven, let me tell you. I mean, folks, can you imagine it? This is the Shangri-La of bliss. This is the place where it all happens. In his little database, this is where we figured out the secret to happiness. And so, sure enough, Weiner decides to start his whole exploration there. He flies over to the Netherlands, sits down with Vinderhoven, and decides to ask him some questions about how he goes about this. And so he is unbelievably excited about going to this institute. I mean, because after all, this is where the collected wisdom on happiness resides. I mean, this is where we're going to go figure it out, right? So he goes and shows up that day, and he's so excited, walks inside, and all of a sudden it's this quiet room with a bunch of academics huddled over computers crunching numbers. Nobody's laughing. Nobody's smiling. There's no joy. You said this is a very odd place to discover where happiness is, but you know, maybe you got to go to the dean. Maybe you got to go to Ruud Vinderhoven himself. And so he sits down and has his interview with Vinderhoven, spends an hour talking about his methodology, an hour talking through the history of happiness studies, an hour talking about the database itself. But then he finally, after an hour, gets to the question that he flew thousands of miles to ask. Well, Dr. Vinderhoven, are you happy? And Vinderhoven sat back in his chair as if he's never been asked this and sits back and said, well, no, the dean of happiness studies isn't happy. This is wrong, folks. All this tells me is we shouldn't leave it up to academics to tell us what happiness is. But do we know what happiness is? I mean, here we are 2 days before New Year's. Do we know what it is to lead a good and productive life? Said another way, do we know what the meaning of life is? I mean, when someone tells you, well, I'm off thinking about the meaning of life, that usually means they're wasting their time, right? That's how our culture thinks about it. But what's interesting is that pre-modern societies and pre-modern thinkers made this the object of most of what they did. Trying to answer the question, what is a good life, has occupied the greatest thinkers in human history through most of history. In fact, we can go back all the way to the 4th century BC and see that this is a significant part of what Aristotle wrote about in his ethics. He spends a lot of time talking about what is it to lead a good life. We see this after Jesus comes in the Christian writers. We see this in Augustine, who spends a lot of time talking about what is it to lead a good life. We see this in the medieval period as well, when Thomas Aquinas takes Aristotle and Augustine and synthesizes them together to try and understand what is happiness, what is it to lead a good life. We even see this in the middle of the Enlightenment with philosophers as diverse as John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham, people like Immanuel Kant, and even in the 20th century, someone like Sigmund Freud, all trying to figure out what happiness is about. What's interesting is that they all say the same thing to a certain extent. They all say the same thing, that our goal in life, what we're really after, is happiness. What our goal in life is, what we're really trying to find, is happiness. The things that you do in your life, you do because you think they're going to make you happy. Even when we do things that we shouldn't do, oftentimes we do them because we think they're going to make us happy, even if they won't. So some people cheat on their taxes because they think a little more money will make them happy. Some people cheat on their spouses because they think being in the arms of another person will make them happy. Some people lie and cheat and do all kinds of things thinking that it will make them happy. But friends, do we know what happiness is? 2 days before New Year's, as we start to think about heading into a new year, do we know what the good life is really all about? And this is especially important in our country because our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, says we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, of these including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Do we know what Jefferson was talking about here? Because what Jefferson didn't mean when he writes the pursuit of happiness, he doesn't mean subjective happiness. He doesn't mean happiness like the culture talks about it today. And so the place we're going to have to start today is to try and define what our terms are. We're going to try and have to understand what happiness is really all about. And I thought the best way to do that would actually just be to start with what the dictionary says. This is Webster's dictionary definition for happiness. It comes in three glosses. Webster says happiness is, first, good fortune or prosperity. Secondly, happiness is a state of well-being or contentment. And thirdly, happiness is pleasurable satisfaction. Notice that what Webster does a marvelous job of doing is capturing what our culture says happiness is all about. You see, what our culture thinks about happiness is that it's subjective. Our culture thinks that happiness is something, well, that just kind of happens to you. In fact, we get the English word happiness from an old English word, which was hap, which is the same word we get happenstance from. It's the same word we get happening from. Happiness is just something that happens to you. So you happen to have the right job and get a big bonus at the end of the year, and that makes you happy. You happen to have married the right spouse, and so you have a happy marriage, and that's why that occurs. You happen to have nice weather where you live. You happen to be healthy. All kinds of things that just happen to you that you have no control over, and therefore it's subjective, and therefore there's nothing we can really do to work on it. But what Jefferson was talking about, and frankly what all pre-modern thinkers thought about happiness, was almost the exact opposite of that. Almost everyone who has looked at this before the modern era said happiness is something objective, not subjective. Happiness is something that is ultimately spiritual. It is ultimately the combination of a robust spiritual life and bringing that together with a material life that makes sense. What happiness is about is something that you can actually work on. And what almost everybody said in the pre-modern era is, in fact, you can influence your happiness by the pursuit of virtue. That what you've been put on this earth to do is to accumulate virtue. That to lead a good life is to lead a happy life. So the question I have is, how come we never talk about this in church? If this is so important, if this is central to our lives, how come this never comes up in church? How come this isn't the 150th sermon you've heard on this, and you start to roll your eyes? Maybe you're rolling your eyes for other reasons, but I mean, you start to roll your eyes and say, oh, this again. Oh, come on. I know this already. Folks, why don't we ever talk about this? I have a theory. As Protestants, we are so scared of works righteousness. We are so scared of your thinking, okay, we found this clever backdoor way to sneak works into the gospel, that we just avoid the whole subject entirely. We spend all our time preaching a gospel, rightly preaching a gospel that needs to be heard in a culture. But we never get around to saying, what are we supposed to do while we're here? Folks, far too many Christians think of the Christian life as, well, I prayed a prayer one day, I'm saved, I'm going to heaven, and, well, I just need to make sure I keep the rules while I'm here. you know, I need to make sure that, you know, I don't break any of the Ten Commandments. I need to make sure I don't cheat on my wife. I need to make sure I don't lie. I need to make sure I keep the rules while I'm here. And I definitely need to make sure I'm giving, because that's what I'm told to do a lot. But friends, is this all we're on earth to do? Is all we're on earth to do to keep some rules and to just kind of keep our noses clean while we're here so that we can go to heaven someday when everything will be right? Let me say very clearly, I can't today promise you perfect happiness in this life. I can't. I can't promise you perfect happiness in a sinful world. Ultimately, perfect happiness will come when we are in the presence of Almighty God. Perfect happiness will come after resurrection when we receive new bodies and we don't have pain anymore and we don't have corruption anymore. Perfect happiness will ultimately come when we don't have a sin nature anymore, the thing that separates us from God. The only thing that is truly going to make us happy is God. Let me be very clear about that. But that doesn't mean that we can't work on this while we're here on earth. And what almost all Christian pre-modern thinkers understood was that by the accumulation of virtue, we have something to add to this. And so what I mean by virtue is something that brings health to your soul, a series of habits that will bring health to your soul. And ultimately, that's what happiness is. Happiness is having a healthy soul. Happiness is ultimately having that, that intersection between our minds and our hearts when it all comes together. But when we think about virtue, what people have told us through time is that there are seven virtues. There are three what we call theological virtues and four what we call cardinal virtues. The three theological virtues are things you can't work on because they're gifts from God. The three theological virtues are simply gifts of grace that God gives to you. The three theological virtues are faith, hope, and love, exactly what Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 13. Faith is the gift of salvation, the gift that God gives to us to enable us to believe. You know, in Baptist churches, we often use the language, someone made a decision for Christ. But we need to understand that even when you make a decision for Christ, this was enabled by Almighty God. The only thing that makes it Christian is to understand that what God gives us is the ability to believe. But then secondly, we understand hope is persevering in this faith. If you want to know who Christians are, look around and see who's persevering in the faith. See who, in the midst of the difficulties of their life, in the midst of the intellectual doubts that they have, in the midst of all the uncertainty that life throws at us, that they're putting one step in front of another and maintaining their faith. And then the third theological virtue is love. Folks, what we're talking about in love is we're talking about agape love. We're talking about the same love that Christ had for us. The love that Christ gave to us, that self-sacrificial love that we know as supernatural love, that unless God gives us the ability to do that, we can't do it on our own. So the three theological virtues are gifts from God. They're pure gifts of grace. But the four cardinal virtues are things that we can work on. As believers, we don't do this by ourselves. The Spirit enables this. The Spirit helps us with this. But the four theological virtues are things like temperance, things like justice, things like courage, and things like wisdom. Temperance, justice, courage, and wisdom are all things that we can work on in this life. And by the way, this helps to explain how unbelievers can actually have a degree of virtue. A lot of times I've heard in the church that you can't be a good person unless you're a Christian. And I always struggled with that because I had unbelieving friends who had great marriages. I had unbelieving friends that were doing unbelievable things in the community in a self-sacrificial way, and I could never make sense of it until I understood this teaching, that there are things that we can work on in this life, and unbelievers can do that as well. What I want to try and show you today is that the accumulation of virtue, working out your faith in virtue, is what the Scriptures tell us to do. And I want to try and show you that by having you turn to 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter chapter 1, where we're going to see how Peter takes all seven virtues that we just talked about and then discusses how we should bring these in to our Christian lives. And what he's going to do for us is help to define what it is to lead a good life. So let's see this in 2 Peter chapter 1. Peter starts in verse 3. His divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire. Now, folks, I know this is going back a ways, but if you were here in November when I taught, we asked the question then, what was the goal of the spiritual life? And we talked about the goal of the spiritual life, that through the Spirit, we become ever closer to God. The goal of the spiritual life, as Peter says here, is to become a partaker of the divine nature. The goal of the spiritual life is to be indwelt by the Spirit and thus to experience God within us in an ever real way. And so all we're doing really from here is we're talking about now how Peter tells us to go about doing that. If the goal of the spiritual life is to become a partaker of the divine nature, what Peter is going to show us in the subsequent verses is how we do that. And what you're going to see is exactly what we've talked about in terms of the development of virtue. He's going to bring right into this passage to show us that this is what we need to do. So let's see what he says in verse 5. For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue. Now, I know in the New American Standard, it says to add to your faith moral excellence. What's the Greek word that's being used here is the word arete. Now, if you've ever read any Greek literature, you may have come across this word arete, because it's simply the most important word in classical Greek civilization. There is no more important word. If you've ever read Homer, for example, ever read the Iliad or the Odyssey, you'll find that the heroes in these great poems, the poems that everybody read in their education for thousands of years, were trying to exhibit this characteristic of arete. Arete means simply virtue, but it also means excellence. It's the idea of having a life that is devoted to excellence, a life that is devoted to virtue. And so Odysseus in the Odyssey or Achilles in the Iliad, these are examples of what great virtue looks like, of what excellence in a life looks like. So when Peter uses the word arete here, he's trying to invoke in his readers something that they would have all understood in their educations. And he's also trying to go back to verse 3 when it talks about Christ, the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence. It's the exact same word, arete. In other words, our best example as Christians for what arete is about is ultimately Jesus himself. But how can I bring this into our culture today? I mean, how can we understand this concept of virtue and arete today? And the best example I could come up with was to remember someone named Chesley Sullenberger. You may remember Chesley Sullenberger from 2009 because he was a pilot for U.S. Airlines. And Sullenberger was taken off on a routine flight from LaGuardia Airport going down to Charlotte as the pilot when all of a sudden his Airbus plane hit a flock of Canadian geese and it shut down both engines. Now, this would be bad. Okay, I don't know much about flying, but losing both engines about 2 minutes into flight is not good. So all of a sudden, Sullenberger had to figure out what to do. He had about 3 minutes before that plane was going to be on the ground. And so first thing he did is radio the tower, say he had a problem, and thought about trying to go back to the airport, but he realized he wouldn't make it. The second thought was, well, maybe I can make it to Bergen County in New Jersey. There was an airstrip right across the Hudson River. But the risk of not making it was huge because there were houses everywhere. And so what he decided he was going to have to do was to ditch the plane in the Hudson River. He decided that the only option he really had was to try and crash land that plane in the river. And folks, there are literally hundreds of things that he had to do without any power, without any navigation systems to make that happen. And by the way, he had to do it as part of second nature because, you know, he didn't have time to look it up in a manual about what he should do. He didn't have time to go radio the tower and get instructions on what to do. He had to instinctively go about trying to prepare that plane for a crash landing with 159 people on board. For example, he needed to get the nose up just enough to slow down the plane, but not too much, because he had to figure out a way to clear the George Washington Bridge. The fact is, he cleared it by about 900 feet. And he couldn't just put the plane down in the river, because if he put it down with the nose down too much, all of a sudden the plane might flip over. All of a sudden the fuselage might break apart, and everybody on board could die. He had to set it down just perfectly at just the right speed, at just the right point in the river, so that there were boats around that could go out and save these people. And as we know from the news reports, he did a remarkable job. People called it a miracle. And I don't want to say anything against that this was an absolute miracle. But ladies and gentlemen, this pilot is a perfect example of arete because he had been a pilot for 39 years. He had spent week in and week out, year in and year out, developing the skills that he needed to draw on. In fact, on the weekends, he was a glider pilot and was an instructor to teach people how to glide planes. This is the absolute perfect training to try and take a plane down in 3 minutes, because all of a sudden, all of his experience was put into play for that very moment. That's what arete looks like. You see, virtue is not something you just say, okay, well, I'm going to be virtuous this year. Virtue is something that you have to work at. Virtue is something that doesn't just happen to us. It is entirely possible to go through a life and have many gifts from God, but to be underdeveloped in terms of our characters. Virtue is something that Sullenberger shows us, in no uncertain terms, is something that is available to all of us. So let's look at how Peter continues in verse 5. He says, "For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge." What Peter is telling us is that the first place that we start is by renewing our minds, exactly what Paul talked about in Romans 12. The place that we start is by making sure we know what to do, by making sure that we are working in our minds, that we are developing our intellects, that we aren't just standing still in the Christian life, but that we're moving forward. Friends, can I just ask you a question? When was the last time you read a real book? I mean, when was the last time you read something by C.S. Lewis, for example? C.S. Lewis's most, one of his most famous books is called Mere Christianity, which is probably the best apologetics book that's been written in the last 100 years to explain what the Christian faith is all about. Or maybe that's not for you, or you've read it already. Have you ever read his most popular book, which is called The Screwtape Letters? I mean, The Screwtape Letters is this great fictional book where he creates this dialogue between a junior demon and a senior demon trying to undermine somebody's faith. And they talk about all these strategies that they can use to undermine someone's faith. It's just a marvelous way of looking at the Christian life. But maybe you're the kind of person who thinks, well, you know, I'm really concerned about our culture because we've lost a notion of transcendent morality. We've lost, taking the Ten Commandments out of courtrooms is the worst thing we could possibly think of. Well, if that's you, you need to read C.S. Lewis's essay called The Abolition of Man, in which he talks about the implications of taking a transcendent morality out of our education system. And the picture that he paints isn't pretty, but it's done in this amazing prose and in this beautiful writing that really makes it a pleasurable to read. But maybe you're the kind of person who says, oh, come on, the last thing I need is some more books to read. Well, then at least make use of what your church is offering you. You know, in the spring, in January, the church is offering another round of Discipleship University. And they're bringing in top-name professors to go teach courses. I mean, they're bringing in Charles Ryrie. Ryrie is one of the famous DTS theology profs who taught generations of pastors theology. He's teaching a course on what did Jesus think about certain things. I think that'd be a pretty good use of time. They're teaching courses on the history of doctrine. They're teaching courses on Old Testament and New Testament survey. They're bringing in the head of the preaching department from Southwestern to teach a course on Galatians. I mean, your church is trying to give you resources for you to develop your minds. One of the things that we all need to do in 2013 is turn off the TV, start getting our nose into some books, and start making use of the resources that are there, because Peter tells us that this is the place that we start. We need to make sure we're developing our knowledge. But Peter doesn't end there either. He says, "For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control." This corresponds to the virtue of temperance. Self-control is all about having temperance. Now, usually when we talk about temperance, we usually talk about this in regard to alcohol, or we talk about temperance in regard to food. But friends, you've heard that sermon before. You've probably heard that sermon a million times, so I'm not going to do that sermon again. The fact is, with regard to temperance, what I want to talk about here is temperance with regard to money, because this almost never gets talked about in the church. Friends, do you realize that the pursuit of wealth is an impediment to your spiritual life? It's not a help to your spiritual life. I say that because I just finished a book by Peter Brown. It's a 500-page book. Peter Brown is a prof at Princeton and probably the leading scholar about late antiquity in Augustine. And he wrote a book that focused from 300 to 600 about the church's views of wealth as it was just getting going. And although the church has many eras and many different things that it brings to this period, the thing that everybody agreed on is that wealth was a hindrance to your spiritual life. Wealth, by enabling you to be independent, wealth, by enabling you to do things on your own, allowed you to basically ignore God. And we need to remember what the scriptures tell us about this. Remember what Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes, that he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. And we need to remember what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. You cannot serve two masters, for either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot love both God and money. You see, friends, money cannot make us happy because money is a means to an end rather than an end. Money can be used for many good purposes, and I need to be clear that there's nothing inherently wrong with money. Obviously, we need to put shelter over our heads. Obviously, we need to put food in our stomachs. I'm not trying to rail against money. I'm just trying to rail against our culture's notion that somehow you're going to be happy if you have enough money. Because money has this strange characteristic to it that there's never enough. John D. Rockefeller was once asked, you know, he's the world's first modern billionaire, and he was asked, well, Mr. Rockefeller, how much is enough? And he looked at the reporter and said, just a little bit more, right? Your money can never have a limit to it. So, for example, if I love gourmet food and decide to have 3 gourmet meals a day, well, eventually I'm going to get full. And eventually I'm going to gain so much weight that I'm not going to be able to eat anymore. But money's not that way. There's no natural limit to it. And thus we have to be temperate with our pursuit of money, making sure that it doesn't have a hold on our hearts. Let's go back to what Peter says in verse 5. For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, virtue with knowledge, knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness. Steadfastness corresponds to the virtue of courage. Now, we all know from looking at our military that courage is something that can be developed. We know that we can take people and train them to do extraordinary things. I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks, gee, I think I'm going to jump on a grenade today. But yet, people in the military are able to train even at very young ages to be able to do this. But I think the hardest thing in the world is to live in prosperity. The hardest thing in the world is to live like we do in Dallas, which, like it or not, is one of the wealthiest places in the wealthiest country that the world has ever known. How do we develop courage when we are in peace and prosperity, basically, in where we live? Friends, the way that we do that is by the small decisions that we make every day. It's by the small decisions that we make to do things, frankly, that we don't want to do. I mean, some days we don't want to get up and go to work. Some days we don't want to get up and exercise. Some days we don't want to get up and do the things that God has called us to do. But it's in those daily decisions, it's in those little decisions that we take day in and day out that build courage. Frankly, this is one of the ways that we explain what James says in the beginning of James when he says, count it all joy when trials come to you of various kinds. You see, what James is saying there is that you know that you have courage when you're tested, and it seems that God simply loves to bring testing into our lives. He's going to do that with us because he's promised to do that as well. For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, virtue with knowledge, knowledge with self-control, self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness. Friends, we know godliness when we see it, don't we? We know godliness when we're in the presence of it, and it is a sight to behold because there's moral authority that comes with godliness. There's something special that comes with godliness. And the best way to develop godliness, frankly, is suffering. The best way to develop godliness and the moral authority that comes with it is being willing to suffer on behalf of other people who couldn't ever pay us back. You know, the best example I can think of with this is Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa, of course, went to India and started a ministry for the least of these, started a ministry for those who, at the bottom end of the caste system, had nobody to take care of them as they were dying gruesome deaths, as they were diseased, as they were in pain. She would take care of them and give them dignity as they were dying. I mean, this is a little Albanian nun who went there with no money, who went there with no organization, and just decided to go start serving some people. It is absolutely remarkable what will happen if we will step out and do something like that, if we will step out and be willing to suffer alongside other people who can't pay us back. Well, in 1982, Mother Teresa was invited to give the Class Day speech at Harvard for their graduation. Class Day is a really fun time because all the different schools come together right in front of Memorial Church in Harvard Yard, and there's usually some speaker. When Laurelie and I were there, unfortunately, it was Quincy Jones. We didn't quite get the same thing as Mother Teresa. But Harvard invited Mother Teresa to come speak with this you know, kind of obsequious invitation. They wanted to invite a famous person in one of the poorest nations on earth to address students who wanted to be famous in one of the richest nations on earth. Well, Harvard didn't quite get what they were expecting when they got Mother Teresa, because in the middle of her commencement address, she turned around to the administration and criticized them for their invitation. She said, "Your invitation shows that you really don't understand very much." Imagine saying that to the Harvard president. You don't understand very much because you think India's poor. Oh, of course, India's poor in terms of money, but she's rich in terms of her spirituality. She's rich in terms of what she believes. She's rich in terms of her history of interacting with spiritual things. No, the one who is poor is you. The one who is poor is you because you have lost any sense of transcendent morality. You have lost any sense of God, and it all happens right here. And you want to know the proof to it? It's because you kill your babies. She said that. She said that, and they all clapped. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what godliness looks like. Would that we remembered that the thing that enables us to speak to a decadent culture, a culture that has lost any sense of transcendent morality, a culture that has lost its sense of God, is that we are called to suffer. You see, when we suffer alongside people, it gives us the ability to talk to a culture that otherwise isn't going to listen. Mother Teresa is the perfect example of someone who did that, someone who exhibited godliness, and thus was truly able to impact the people who are around her. For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue with knowledge, knowledge with self-control, self-control with steadfastness, steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection. Folks, the Greek word that underlies this is the word Philadelphia, and it means brotherly love, just like the place Philadelphia means. My question to you on this one is, do you have a friend? Do you have a friend you're walking through the Christian life with? Because what Peter's trying to say here is you can't do this alone. Virtue is not meant to be meant to come up out of thin air. Virtue is not meant to be done on your own. Virtue is meant to be done in the context of community, in particular with someone who knows you really well. You know, you might say, well, that's why I come to Sunday school. I've got all kinds of friends all over here. But do you have someone who really knows you? Do you have someone who really knows what you're concerned about? Do you have someone who really knows the things that you don't talk about much publicly, and someone who you can tell anything to, and he'll love you anyway? Folks, my friend is John Cox. John is executive pastor over at Watermark, and John and I have been friends for over a decade. We went to Harvard Business School together, and we're in a study group there. And one of the exciting things about moving to Dallas for me was I was going to get to rekindle my friendship with John. Sure, you know, every time I was here on a business trip, I'd go see him. He had five kids. They'd all jump over me. It was really fun. But, you know, you lose some sense of that closeness if you're not in the same place. And so we had all these good intentions when I got here. But sure enough, after 3 months, we were busy and not doing much. And so one day we sat down with our calendars open and we said, okay, how are we going to be intentional about this? How are we going to figure out how to get together? And frankly, our schedules were just impossible. We just kind of scratched our head and couldn't figure it out, and figured out there was only one time that we could protect for each other, and that was on Saturday morning at 6 a.m. And so for the last 3.5 years, John and I, sometimes very grumpily, get together at 6 a.m., and sometimes we exercise, sometimes we just walk, sometimes we just talk. But we're going through life together because, you see, that's what life was meant to be. Friends, John couldn't be more different than I am. He doesn't care at all about theology, okay? He cares a whole lot about leadership and about running a church, but he doesn't care about the same things I care about, but that doesn't matter. The fact is that we talk about things that are important in our lives. We talk about what's going on with his kids. We talk about what's going on in the world. We talk about what's going on in sports. I mean, it is just a fun time to get together where there's no agenda, where we simply recognize that we need each other desperately. We can't do this alone. You see, friends, you all need a friend like John. You all need someone to walk through this life, this Christian life, together, because it makes life so much richer. It makes it so much more fun, and it makes it, in fact, possible to do. Peter writes, "For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, knowledge with self-control, self-control with steadfastness, steadfastness with godliness, godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love." Remember, we started in faith, we end in love. We started with a theological virtue that is a gift of grace. We end with a theological virtue that is a gift of grace. And the word here is the word agape. You see, friends, when Jesus told us that the summary of the law is to love God with all your heart and to love your neighbor as yourself, this is ultimately where we end here. Ultimately, the good life, the productive life, the virtuous life is a life that is full of love. Love, first of all, to Almighty God in thankfulness and for all the gifts that he's given to us, but also the remembrance and the realization that it is God that enables us to do much of this, that enables us to walk the Christian life. We start with a recognition of that. But then, ladies and gentlemen, what true happiness is about is pouring our lives into other people, particularly other people who can't pay us back. And it starts with our families. It starts with the people who are around us, but then hopefully grows out to others who are in the community. You see, true love stems from all the other virtues because of what it's what should end up with. It's what we should aspire to be. We should be aspiring to be people who are known for our love. We should be aspiring to be the people that God has called us to be. So friends, if I were to summarize all this today, what a good life is a happy life. And happiness is developed by the pursuit of virtue. Happiness is developed by the pursuit of good things in our lives. And so my wish for all of you in this new year is that you'd experience real happiness. My wish for all of you in this new year is that you would start to understand happiness, not as our culture gives it to us, not as something that's superficial, something that's subjective, something that just happens to you, but as the result of a life that's well-lived. This is what all great thinkers have said through time, but it's something that our culture has lost. It's something that we have lost, even in the church, because we're afraid to tell you that, ladies and gentlemen, we can add something to this. And we have a role and a purpose to be here on earth. God has put us here for a reason. And the virtues that we develop here, God can make use of in eternity. Let's have a great 2013. Let's make it a virtuous and happy year. Let's pray. And so, Father, by the Spirit that indwells us, we ask your blessing on this class, both those who are here and those who aren't. We ask especially for your blessing on those who are sick in our midst, those who aren't here because they're suffering and in pain. But, Father, we ask that you help us think through this new year. Help us to go out and be the servants that you've called us to be. Help us to go out in faith and love, to go develop the lives that you've called us to live, and to be salt and light in a culture that so desperately needs to hear your good news. Father, give us that sense of your mercy, that due sense of your love, so that we can go out and love other people. Father, we praise you for all the blessings of this life. We praise you for the love that you've given to us, and ask that you empower us to pour that out to others. And we ask all this through your Son and by your Spirit. Amen.